Side with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught offside from the suburbs of New York City in an apartment in Brooklyn. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
How are you, man?
Doing well. How about you?
I feel chipper. I feel good.
Well, that's good.
One annoying thing about the snow beginning to melt and go away is that construction has resumed on the streets. And so there's a jackhammer going down the street. I hope nobody can hear it, but I'm conscious of it. And I really wanted to be a construction Karen about this and go down there and just say, there's no need for that to be so loud. Could you do it slightly less loud? Which obviously it has to be loud to achieve the maximum boulder breaking that it needs to.
Yes, boulder breaking requires noise. Construction Karen, typically I don't think Karen's move is to politely ask. I think their go-to is right away, let me speak to your manager. I think that's what you need to immediately, that's the gear you have to find if you're going to do this.
Think of me going to a New York construction worker and asking to speak to the manager. The response would be, oh, perfect.
Fun podcast we have coming up for you, despite the fact that JJ and I are coming at this from personal low points. But we will fight through. We will talk about Liverpool and Everton. We will talk about Tottenham and West Ham. And we will do so from the opposing team's perspectives, because that is probably the more fun way to do this. Also, Manchester City continuing to roll. We'll get to all the Premier League stuff that you're going to want to hear about for this week. And then we've got a little bit of a mailbag, JJ.
Yeah,
and then we've got nice, Red Cards and Man of the Match.
Nice little mailbag, Red Cards and Man of the Match. This is a nice podcast.
Yeah. Let's go right into it right now. And let's start with the Merseyside derby from over the weekend. Everton finally do what many of their fans were maybe beginning to think would never happen again, and that is win at Anfield. I've been trying to think about this if you're an Everton supporter, because there are going to be people out there, like your natural cynics, your people who like to kind of like roll their eyes at everything. And those are the people who are going to see the way that Everton celebrated after that game, and they're going to see some of the things that were said by Everton supporters, and they're going to make fun of those people. And I'm here to tell those people to be quiet.
Oh, I am so with you on that. That is absolutely the wrong way to go about it. You can have your, as a Liverpool fan, your recriminations about what happened, and it can hurt you, as it obviously will, but they have every right to celebrate the way they did. The videos that came out of the locker room, which, you know, it was like they'd won something, and they had won something. And, I will put that in, you need to put Everton in a larger context to understand this win. This is not just a regular league win. There's not even me in my Liverpool colored perspective could even see this as, oh, you're celebrating a league win in February. You haven't won anything. That is not the tone to take with this victory.
Yeah, I feel like that's missing the point. And, you know, what really crystallized it, it's a stat that it's almost hard to believe, where I saw Jamie Carragher talk about this, and I think it goes back to 1962. So from 1962 to where we are right now in 2021, Everton have, what is it? They have played 58 matches at Anfield, and they have won 6 of them. I mean, it's just like an incomprehensibly small number, especially given the fact that from within that 60-year time period, Everton have had some really good eras and teams within that. And even and when you look at it, even in those great moments for them, they still couldn't win there. I don't know how you explain it. I mean, Jamie Carragher, he goes on and he spoke about it a little bit on Sky Sports, and he said, I'll tell you the reason, in my experience, that their record is so poor. And also at Goodison, he says, even in the last 20 years as well, he said, Everton never get the derby right emotionally. They're either too up for it and they get players sent off, or they're absolutely terrified going into games, certainly at Anfield. That's his take on how this rivalry has kind of gone over the last several generations.
Well, he's an Everton supporter he's not now, but
no.
I think he was at the 86 Cup final as a blue. So, you know, he came up, or he grew up in the best era of Everton football. Think of it this way. Everton, this isn't a unique position, but you need to put this in context for people who are not Everton supporters. So in the 80s, Everton were toe-to-toe with Liverpool in many seasons. They won the championship in the 80s. They won they won the European Cup Winners' Cup 85 or in 86. And they were one of the premier teams in English football. And they fell off a cliff rather dramatically. They went into the 90s as a strong team. And then by the middle of the 90s, they were fighting relegation. The last cup that they won was in 1995. 4 years later would be the last time until this weekend that they beat Liverpool at Anfield. You know, there's 22-year-olds walking around who are fully fledged Liverpool or Everton supporters, you know, dyed in the wool blues, who've never seen their team until this weekend win at Anfield. This is huge. And also, if this was a team that won championships, was in Europe, and then all of a sudden stopped doing that, you know, what are they supposed to celebrate? Everton have been, apart from a few years under Moyes, nowhere. Like, nowhere. And you don't want them to celebrate this?
It's silliness.
It's craziness.
No, we've talked about this a lot on this podcast about, because you and I, we can only really approach this. You've played it at a higher level than me, certainly, everyone.
And I played at no levels.
Right. But I'm trying to compliment you, okay? This is me reaching out an olive branch of friendship, JJ.
Across the aisle.
But we can really only come at this as fans when we talk on this podcast. And what we say all the time is, like, I'm sorry, no one, I don't care, your Manchester United's, your Manchester City's, whoever, no one wins enough for this to only be about winning. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be more to this than simply trophies. Otherwise, there's no fun to be taken in this ever.
It's so true. Arsene Wenger said it best. He goes, only one team can win the league at the end of the season. You've got to get your joy wherever you can get it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why when I see, and I don't want to pile on the modern fan, but if you're a Liverpool fan from the United States, you've been spoiled for 3 or 4 years now. And this is like crushing. This is crushing that you're now not winning. You're not even good this season. You're quite bad, actually, certainly since Christmas. But that's football. I actually don't want it the other way. Decades upon decades of dominance. I can't imagine what that is like. And I wouldn't want to.
It changes like the wavelengths of your brain, I feel like.
Yeah.
It recompresses the way you view emotion and happiness and dejection. It will change like the makeup of a fan's brain.
If you look at how United, who dominated for the best part of, you know, quarter century, you see some of their fans now that lived through that good period, who aren't even really that old, but will remember, say, 2008 and times like that when they were regular in the Champions League final or winning the Champions League as they did against Chelsea. And their brains can't get their head around the fact that, you know, it's now just one-upmanship. You know, oh, well, we're second. We're Liverpool. You know, well, I mean, you're second, kind of. That's where you are on the table. But, I mean, this is not where you were. Less than a decade ago, it totally changes your brainwaves. Look what it's done to Arsenal fans. Every single season in 20 seasons, they were in the top four, and people made fun of them, and they absolutely took the bit. They would get so angry about being awarded by United or Chelsea fans or wherever a cardboard cutout for like we won fourth, you know, every season, and they didn't realize it. Though that was an incredible achievement. Considering Chelsea and Man City and where they were at, they should have enjoyed. I definitely think they should have enjoyed that run more. And now it's over. And now they're what, 10th? I don't know. I didn't even look at the table today. But yeah. So this is huge. This is huge for Everton fans.
Of course it is.
And Everton have lived on being the huge club in the 1980s that they were. They've lived on not being Liverpool for a long time, and they've also lived on cult heroes, which is what. You know, like Duncan Ferguson, you know, Seamus Coleman now, I would imagine, who was giving verbals to Jurgen Klopp during the game, you know. Mm-hmm. So spiky and prickly are Seamus. But, you know, those are the things that they've lived off. And why would anyone, it's a very narrow prism of joy that you experience in football if you're not totally understanding why Everton went lula after that win at the weekend.
Yeah. And then that's, of course, like the big picture, grand scheme of things, when you're talking about Everton but and that win. But the other element of it is, you know, it's also a team that for the last several years, I would say, have fairly quickly fallen out of whatever top four race they had hoped at the beginning of the season they would be in. And I think this win at Anfield at this stage in the season, in a year where the competition around them is kind of there for the taking potentially, I think this also serves the double purpose of kind of confirming to them, okay, we're in this. This is not, you know, I don't know that Everton are going to qualify for top four. If I had to guess right now, I don't know that they would be in my final predictions at the end of the season. However, like in other seasons, by this point, they would have fallen off and it kind of would have been just a year of like more disappointment for Everton fans. And I think this sent a message that they, I don't know if they'll do it, but they're going to be in this race maybe until the end.
Yeah, I think the question for Everton fans now is, and I don't mean to disparage the victory because I thought they took their goal very well. Actually should have had a second through Seamus Coleman. As good, you know, a ball as that is from Luca Digne, he's got to bury that with the diving header. But you can't be certain that Everton are going to go on a run now if they're going to put 2-3 victories back to back. They haven't really done it all season. And but again, that's something for another day with Everton. You know, where they're going long term looks more positive. They have to negotiate a move to the stadium. There was news today that has been approved. So you know, Everton are in a good place right now, but I wouldn't necessarily say that we are going to see now just a run. This is going to inspire a run till the end of the season, because let's be honest, Everton executed a plan brilliantly at the weekend, but it's a plan that Sean Dyche managed, Graham Potter, who can't win anything, managed, you know, so that may temper prospects for the rest of the season a little bit.
JJ, that's the Everton side of things. Before we even go to Liverpool and their side of it, let's stay with the happy. Okay, we just started the podcast here. We like to start on bright, happy notes. So
stick with the Moisey.
Right. So we'll stick. You know, we just did Merseyside Derby and the winners of that. Let's move now to a London Derby and the winners from that. And that was West Ham with a huge win, 2-1 over Spurs. They remain in the top four, which is it's an amazing accomplishment for them, even at this stage in the season. I'm not trying to sound patronizing or anything like that.
You're really doing a good job.
Well, no, it really is. And I would think even a West Ham supporter would tell you that. And I'll tell you what, we actually have one with us right now as we go in the club with West Ham, Rashane Thomas, West Ham correspondent from The Athletic, kind enough to give us a few minutes right now. Rashane, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm all good. I'm still in the high from that win over Tottenham on Sunday. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I
imagine you are. And I guess we'll start just with kind of like what I was posing there a minute ago. Like, coming from me, a Tottenham supporter, I don't mean for it to sound patronizing in any way, but do you agree that even being where you guys are right now, you know, here mid-February, top four, is this already more of an achievement than whatever you thought you were going to get from this club this season?
Most certainly. I mean, it just feels weird being considered all for Europe. Like, West Ham top four, but it never happens. Usually we're used to, like, West Ham just about surviving in the league, maybe top 10 if we're lucky. But the fact that West Ham actually, you know, challenge for Europe in top four merit, doing much better than other London clubs like Arsenal, Tottenham, Chelsea. It's just remarkable, really. And as you touched on, bearing in mind last season, West Ham just about stayed up. And West Ham could potentially be, you know, finishing the top four. And it's all down to Kevin Moyes. It really is. All down to him and the fact he's got the players to have the self-belief that they can, you know, go one step further and challenge for Europe. Even if West Ham don't finish in top four, maybe a top six. It's just incredible.
Rochelle is... What's Moyes done different? Because let's be fair, when the board, Gold and Sullivan and Brady said Moyes was coming back, he wasn't exactly greeted with open arms by the West Ham faithful. So what's been different this time round about his approach to the side?
A number of things, really. The main one is obviously recruitment's been a lot better. We've seen players like Thomas Suchet, Vladimir Saval, Saban Rama, Craig Dawson. Craig Dawson's been playing so great. West Ham fans are calling him Virgil van Dawson after Virgil van Dijk. So that's how what he's been doing. And obviously, we've seen it all have an impact. Previously, West Ham would sign players. You wouldn't, you know, do particularly great. So now it's great that Moyes has signed players having an impact, and there's a great togetherness and a brotherhood in this team. It's not like 11 individuals, it's an actual team that I want to do off for each other. So that's the first one. Second one, it's just a case of like training. I know it sounds so simple, but like players is on it in training now. Before under Pellegrini, it'd sort of be like, if you didn't play one training, you'd still be in starting 11 for a match. Whereas now, if you're not playing one training, you won't be on the bench. You know what I mean? So you have to be on it all the time. And we're seeing that sort of competitiveness in the team. You don't play well, someone like, for example, look at defense. Fabian Barbena came in for Diop. Barbena missed the game. Craig Dawson came in. Ogbonna got injured. Diop come in for him and playing well. Like players know, if you get an opportunity, you've got to grab it with both hands. And we're seeing that a lot. So, and obviously a huge shout out to Moyes' backroom staff, Paul Nevlin, Stuart Pearce, Kevin Nolan, Alan Irvin, all doing a remarkable job as well. So all in all, that's the main reasons why West Ham have been just so incredible this season, because of all those reasons.
Yeah, you mentioned all that and you talk about what a team effort it's been for this group, but I'm curious to even go a little more specific, like who are the players for this West Ham side that are, in your estimation, at least overperforming, that have helped them get to kind of the heights that they're at right now?
Oh, that's a great question. I'd probably say the first one really is Antonio, because we all know he's capable of scoring goals, but with Antonio, it's a case of, oh, can he do it for like a sustained period? Previously, Antonio would score like maybe 2 or 3 goals and he'll sort of go quiet for the next 2 or 3 months. Whereas now, he's been a remarkable, more consistent goal scorer. And then obviously, that was Moyes. Moyes had the vision to turn him from a winger into a forward. So that's great. Cresswell, oh my goodness. Again, West Ham fans started calling him, is it Paolo Maldini, the former AC Milan fullback? Is it Maldini? Yeah, but they're calling him Maldini now, like the English Maldini. It's just hilarious. He's been great for another player who's benefited from Moyes being manager. Craig Dawson, oh, what a signing he turned out to be. I'll be honest, when he first joined, I was thinking, Craig Dawson, really? Craig Dawson, the ball player to sign? And now look, dare I say it, probably perhaps in good contention to be involved in the England squad soon. So he's another player that's played well. But the one player who I really think is taking the game to the next level on the more is Declan Rice. We all know how talented he is, but I've seen a leader in Declan Rice, only 21 years old, and what he's doing on a regular basis. Bearing in mind, Mark Noble's not playing, which he's the captain for West Ham, but he's at an age now where he's not guaranteed minutes. Whereas Declan Rice is taking on that mantle of captain, always giving instructions to players. Players look at him as the sort of leader to lead by example. So, yeah, definitely Declan Rice of all who benefited from Moyes returning.
Yeah, Rosh, I don't want to go down this road. It's a negative road, but I might as well. So if you look at the tandem of Rice and Souček in the middle of the park, like you said, Declan Rice has been fantastic, and we all know the talent he has. We all know that there's probably some vultures circling the West Ham nest in terms of trying to pry him away. So we're in this moment where, let me give you the scenario. Things are good. The West Ham support are happy, albeit they're not in the ground, so it doesn't really matter, but they're happy. The board, for once, don't have the heat on them that they've had for the past how many years. Big part of the board taking the club to the London Stadium was that increased revenue, push for Europe, more money would mean that they wouldn't sell their best players. So is the next, I guess, what would you call it, fracture point for the fans going to be this summer and where Declan Rice ends up?
The big thing about it is obviously last season was huge in terms of Declan Rice. If West Ham had suffered relegation, it would have already been Declan Rice. It would have been other players who left to join other clubs. But I'd say that the fact that Chelsea sacked Frank Lampard, that's one less burden for West Ham fans to worry about, because he was the biggest person that Chelsea trying to sign Declan Rice. He was a huge fan. The ball that West Chelsea weren't so keen on Declan Rice, but Frank Lampard was like, listen, we need to sign this guy. Like, he's really good. So now he's no longer in charge at Chelsea. West Ham fans are like, oh, hallelujah. Like praise the Lord. Now, what I mean? Now we can sort of sleep easier now. And I feel like for someone like Declan Rice, listen, he cares about West Ham, but it's about the club challenging for like Europe and making that next step, not just staying up.
So he has to stay then?
He has to stay. And the club has to show that ambition that, listen, we can be challenging for Europe on a regular basis so we can get players like you to be committed, get players like Antonio to be committed, Souček to be committed, because there'll be other clubs interested in signing someone Souček, that's for sure. He's a box-to-box midfielder, scoring so many goals. So other clubs will be looking at him. So it's about West Ham showing, listen, we can challenge for Europe, we can recruit well, like believe in us, and we can keep doing good stuff. And for me, I feel like when it comes to Declan Rice, listen, we're always talented, but the grass is always green on the other side. Like, there's been players who joined big clubs, it hasn't really worked out for them. I look at someone like Declan Rice, the fans love you, they adore you. Like, if you were to go to a club like Chelsea, Man United, you'd just be like another regular person. Whereas at West Ham, you actually have a club that they can build around you. So that would be my advice to Declan Rice.
Rash, I just wouldn't hang my hat on Declan Rice's loyalty. Being an Irishman, I kind of know how that goes.
You know, it's funny, one other signing with West Ham that, I don't know when it happened, at least, you know, from our perspective, it didn't really register in a major way for us on this podcast. We might have given a brief mention and that was it, and that was Jesse Lingard. And I feel like he's come on for West Ham and he's made the
story. Andrew, I'm going to have to correct you. It's Jay Lings.
Jay Lings. Come on, Andrew. Yeah. Come on.
It's my bad. My bad, everyone. Apologies. Jay Lings has come on to West Ham and he's made an impact that, I'll say for myself, I did not see this coming. And I'm wondering, what was the feeling from West Ham supporters when he was brought in? Was it kind of like, all right, I don't know what this does, or was it like, all right, we can make this work? What was the feeling on him?
At first, I guess it was a bit of frustration, but not aimed at Lingard. It's aimed at the fact that West Ham, you know, failed to sign a striker. A lot of West Ham fans are like, we need to get a striker in, we need to get a backup for Antonio. So when we signed Lingard alone, it's like, yeah, it's good we have Lingard, but where's the striker? Who's going to score like 10 goals between now and the end of the season? So I'm just happy for Lingard that it's working out well so far. I wrote a piece for The Athletic, just looking back on Lingard's journey to the club. I spoke to Lee Clark, his ex-manager at Birmingham City, and Renny Monenstein, who we all know was a big factor behind, you know, Alex Ferguson's success at Man United. And Renny Monenstein told me, listen, this guy is amazing. Like, his work rate is just second to none. If he keeps playing well, you know, does all the right stuff, there's no reason why he can't be involved in England squad. So I sort of put this tweet out with that quote. And people were like, England squad, Jesse Lingard, what on earth are you talking about? Like, it's not going to happen. And now look, 3 goals in the space of a month, become a big player for West Ham, popular member in the dressing room. His personality is already rubbing off on players. We saw the celebration against Tottenham, with the whole playing the flute and Fornals playing the guitar, Declan Rice playing the drums. That is Lingard. His personality is already rubbing off on the players. And it's good to have players like that. We touched on earlier the recruitment. And as I mentioned, West Ham having players that are like individuals, we're seeing the brotherhood, the togetherness, and Lingard's definitely been a big factor behind that.
Last one for me, Rash. So what's, look, dreaming, obviously the top four is you're there now. What's going to be, well, where do you expect West Ham to finish? Let me ask it straight like that, rather than just say, because obviously the dream is top four. Where do you expect them to finish now?
Definitely top four. Definitely top four. Listen, I'll tell you what, yeah, I need to work on my cardio, because if West Ham finish the top floor, I'm doing backflips all over East London. That's how happy I'll be. But yeah. Listen, we're very merit right now. It's in our hands. I know there's some tough games coming up, but listen, people wrote off Leicester City when they won the Premier League during that season. People thought their form would like drop off eventually. And people are sort of saying the same for West Ham and top four. And I see a team on a weekly basis who keep proving doubt was wrong. Like, there's no reason why West Ham can't finish the top four this season.
This is more doable than Leicester winning the championship, let's be honest.
Yeah, I'll say so.
I think that's reasonable. Well, I say this somewhat begrudgingly. Good luck to you and to your club. Rashane Thomas from The Athletic, we appreciate you giving us some time talking West Ham today. Thanks so much, man.
No, much appreciated. Thanks for having me on.
Our thanks to Rashane Thomas,
the happiest man in East London.
Yeah, I can picture just like, you know, on the local news, a report of like a man is just like kicking people around East London on doing backflips incessantly. He can't stop himself. Look, I get it. Like, we were just talking about the joy for an Everton supporter, and like it kind of in some ways goes hand in hand with West Ham, not specifically in necessarily the club that they've beaten. I mean, West Ham have actually had some pretty good success against Tottenham in recent years, even when Tottenham were at their best. But just what it means for them and for their season. Like, I wonder if you're West Ham, and like Rashane was saying, you're kind of going into most seasons with the expectation of, let's just be mid-table, let's just stay up. And then you beat Spurs to you know, move or remain in the top four, it's kind of like with Everton sending a message to other clubs, like that this is, at least to a West Ham supporter, okay, now we know this is not just fool's gold, that we are actually a part of this race. Again, like I said with Everton, whether or not they're able to stay in it throughout the remainder of the season, I don't know. And again, when I make my predictions on what the top four will be, I don't know that I'll have West Ham in it for me. But here and now, watching that game, look, West Ham played a great first half. And then I'll say this, bitter Spursy Andy, I thought they were a little bit fortunate to have hung on to all 3 points in the second half. I think Tottenham did apply a lot of pressure, and West Ham, after scoring that early goal in the second half through Lingard, and credit to them for getting it, they were able to then change the way they wanted to play and be more defensive, but they didn't try to score after that. And Tottenham got pretty close, but look, that's how this game goes. So props to them, man.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on something that Rash said there. He was talking about Aaron Cresswell and, you know, people comparing him to Paolo Maldini, which, you know, I mean, it's probably is funny and over the top. But the 31-year-old has made more final third passes, 245, and has created more chances from set play as 21 than any other defender in the league. West Ham scored more set-piece goals than any other Premier League side, with four of Cresswell's six assists coming in this manner. So I read that in Football London this morning, and I just thought, that is excellent production from Aaron Cresswell. It's also the attention to detail on set-pieces has kind of become the hallmark of Moyes at West Ham.
Yeah. Yeah, it has. I mean, they got, you know, their first goal in this game, it wasn't a set piece, but it almost looked like one with the amount of time that Jarrod Bowen was given to play in that ball. And it was perfect. Antonio got, you know, good piece on it. Lloris made a nice save, but he had no shot on the second. So, yeah, I mean, West Ham, they're, look, I did my back padding last week, and I guess I should continue it here. Like, I kind of said this before the season, that if you looked at their starting 11, you know, and compared them with some of the other bigger, quote unquote, bigger sides, you could see before the year that they had an opportunity to go toe to toe with some of those teams. Now, like, that's easier said than done. Players have to stay healthy. Players who, you know, who we may look at in a certain light have to play up to what those capabilities and expectations are. And up till now, they have. And I don't think you can necessarily look at where West Ham are and say that this is any kind of fluke. I think that this is a legitimately good team, and their manager right now has kind of turned back the clock in terms of his own career, and is looking more like the, like you had said before, kind of like the prime Everton days, David Moyes.
I think it's a nice mix of West Ham being organized and good at certain things, with a sprinkling of good players and good signings, as Rosh mentioned, and also the nature of the season that we're having right now, and they're capitalizing on it, and fair play to them.
So that's the happy, JJ.
All right.
Everton, West Ham, I guess we should take a look at the other side of this, and that is two clubs that, I mean, depending who you ask, are both now falling into various states of crisis. I guess I'll ask you first with Liverpool. Is that overstating it to even throw the word crisis into a sentence with Liverpool right now?
I mean, it's not good. crisis is, maybe crisis is a bit strong, but like it has been a disaster since Christmas. Let's be perfectly honest. It's not been good at all. And the weekend was just another kind of Groundhog Day, a perfect encapsulation of a season gone wrong. They concede early and you never feel like they're going to get back in, or it's not fair to say you never feel like they're going to score.
Come on, say it. Come on.
No, well, you don't feel like they're going to score these days. Or if they do, it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort. And against the Carlo Ancelotti side that was very well organized and compact, it was going to be very difficult. And then we get an injury as well with Jordan Henderson, which just, I mean, that is the...
Unbelievable.
Yeah, incredible. Non-contact injury as well when he's running. So... You are in crisis mode, because you look up now and you think, where is the next win going to come from? What are they going to do? What can they possibly do to change things, to make things better? To, you know, the pace of play is, I still think, is a huge problem against the low block sides. We don't move the ball quick enough to disrupt their defenses, and I don't know how that changes. Yeah, it's there's a real danger of, you know, you've got on the cards coming up. You've got Timo Werner on his way to Anfield. Against what centre-back pairing? We don't know yet.
Well, Kabak and Davies.
Kabak plus Davies, Kabak, probably Kabak and Phillips, from what me and you have heard.
Yeah.
From sources suggesting that maybe Davies won't be as prominent a player or as prominent a signing as people have thought. And not that Phillips has done anything wrong in particular, but that is not a quick centre-back pairing. That is not a speedy...
It's a long way from Van Dijk and Matip, or even Van Dijk and Gomez.
Van Dijk and Gomez, yeah, it certainly is. So so there's reason to look at the rest of the season with trepidation, absolutely. Not
the thing
just
with
from...
Liverpool that I keep wondering about is whether or not we're talking about sort of the end product of an exhausting three-year run. This is kind of almost, not to like demean it, but almost a mulligan year. Like, okay, we've look at what we've achieved. This, we were never going to be able to maintain this pace. Guys are missing this season with injuries. It's a chance maybe for some legs to rest up, come back, run it back again next year. We'll be fighting right back again at the top of the table like we have been under Klopp. Is it that, or is this actually the end of some kind of era? And I feel like, well, I almost feel bad bringing this up. This is like a podcast unto itself.
It's impossible to assess end of era status on this. But what you can say is that, I saw Michael Cally tweet this yesterday, and I thought it was pretty good. He said the positive for the club is, the club being Liverpool, is that this desire to, capital letters, find out what's wrong with Liverpool should give them the cover they need to turn over a squad that, while it's fine now, needs an overhaul before everyone actually gets old. There's, as Jamie Carragher pointed out last week, and we talked about it on the podcast, there's a lot of miles on the clock, and teams operate in 3-year cycles, and there are players that need to be moved on, and you can't let's forget about the injuries for a second. Just put them to a side for a second. You're looking to change the game in the second half, and you look at that bench. Where are the game changers? Where are the guys that are going to come in? Now, could this team get a bounce from someone who was supposed to be part of a replenishing of the team? Diogo Jota, he's training now. Maybe he comes back in, Firmino drops to the bench, and things liven up again. Maybe that's it. Maybe, as Carragher suggested, they do a change of formation to something that allows them to play an extra attacker to help out that attack. I don't know, but I don't think it's end of an era stuff. Or certainly it's too early to assess that, but it's certainly end of the first cycle. I mean, teams don't operate in long periods of time anymore. And as we always talk about, even Fergie changed every 3 to 4 years because you have to. And Liverpool are at that point right now, and injuries have not helped them to implement the changes that they wanted in the places that they wanted with Thiago and Diogo Jota. So I think it's too early to say, really, but I'm not afraid to say it's a pretty crap situation right now. Yeah. Certainly.
And much of what you're saying kind of can serve as a nice transition into talking about where Tottenham are at, because I would also agree with you that Tottenham are, if you want to apply the word crisis to where Spurs are at right now, I'd say go ahead by all means, because it certainly feels like that. And, you know, what you talked about with Liverpool, and you always cite Alex Ferguson talking about the 3-year cycles, and if Liverpool are maybe at the end of one of those, you know, that was Tottenham's issue. Pochettino said it in that final season, before his final season, you know, in that season where they made their run to the Champions League final, that this was a squad that needed refreshing. And you kind of see now that in not having really done that to maybe the level that they should have, or certainly at the time in which they should have, they are reaping the, I was going to say rewards, whatever the opposite of a reward is, the circumstances of not having done that. Because some of these players right now are just, you know, I feel bad saying it because some of these guys have been good servants to the club. Eric Dier is kind of one that comes to mind. The back line in general, it's just killing them. It's just killing them. Davinson Sanchez shutting off at the wrong time, allowing Lingard to run right by him on that second goal. I mean, we're seeing, like, you and I were talking before the podcast, and you were like, I don't even know how much to say about Liverpool because I feel like I'm saying the same things every week. And I feel the same way, JJ, about Tottenham, with just backline defenders turning off at the wrong times. It's just like, this is Groundhog Day every week for them right now.
Yeah. I definitely think there needed to be changes made in the center of defense. I certainly think there needed to be, you can't say though that they haven't spent money, Andrew, and you can't say that there hasn't been players brought in for this manager. I'm coming at this from a totally different angle to you. I've consistently said that I think this team and this bunch of players can do better, and that the style of football that they play in is you know. Let me ask you this: do you believe in the concept of like multiple lives? Is there someone out there? There's another Andrew. There's another JJ. Do you believe in that idea that there's someone who?
No, I don't even know what you're talking about.
You know, the idea of a doppelganger. Because I feel I feel right now there's somebody who is a senior player at Tottenham Hotspur who may not look like me, but inhabits my mind. And he's been talking to Jack Pitbrook of The Athletic. And this came out today, Andrew. And, you know, if this sounds like JJ, if this sounds like the drum I've been banging forever, then... you know, maybe there is somebody who is me within Tottenham Hotspur. Jack begins like this: after Tottenham lost their fifth Premier League game out of six, Jose Mourinho insisted that the methods that he and his coaching staff use are second to nobody in the world. But the reality inside the Spurs dressing room is that some players are unhappy with training sessions they think are too defensive, too focused on the opposition, and not as intense as they were used to under Mauricio Pochettino. Everything has changed now. This is a quotation from a player. Everything has changed. Even the training is so defensively minded now, one dressing room source says. There is no plan to move the ball forward. The plan is to defend, boot the ball up to Harry Kane and Son Heung-min, and that's it. Now, that quote on its own is just absolutely astounding, that this is coming from a senior player or a player involved in the squad inside Tottenham Hotspur. And it just brings me back to, remember our review of All or Nothing? And I had this laundry list of Mourinho's negativity. But it was as if I was being like gaslit by all our listeners, not just you, all our listeners. I thought I was going mad because you guys were talking how positive and upbeat he is. Andrew, what we're seeing from Spurs right now, yeah, you can talk about Eric Dier, probably not a centre back. You know, things haven't maybe been completely replenished throughout that squad. But this is the net result of what you get with this manager. And I can't believe that there is, you know, even the question, can he turn it round now? This is over. This is done. And it's done in part because he was the wrong man appointed as manager of Tottenham Hotspur.
Well, the only thing that can be turned around, because I would agree with you, their season is done. But
he's not, but they can't continue to have him as manager. It's okay, not
well,
getting
I don't,
better.
I don't know about firing him right now. I don't know that I would necessarily do that. A, because I just don't know that Tottenham or that club that can keep shelling out millions of dollars to managers that aren't managing their team. I just don't know that they don't have that financial might to do that. And also, like, say what we want about their league campaign. I agree with you. It's in the trash, but they're in a cup final against Manchester City. They're probably still among the three or four favorites for Europa League. And, you know, is he the right guy necessarily to help them win cup competition? Maybe he's better served at this stage in his career to be doing that than managing across an entire league campaign against, you know, lower opposition where he's setting up more defensively. So, like, I would give him the rest of the season, and then I think – they'll probably, I mean, look, if he takes home two trophies, then I guess it's going to be a different conversation. But as it stands right now, I'd give him the rest of the season, see if he can win you at least one of those two, and then you reassess.
Yeah, there's a no-break clause in his contract as well, which complicates everything. Because like you said, he's on a reported 15 million a season.
Tottenham are not, they're not, they've never operated that way. So it would surprise me if they were going to do that now.
It's just been so obvious for so long.
Well, here's the only thing I would say to you, because all of what you're saying is, it's, you say it gaslit by our listeners, but really you're talking about me because I defended Mourinho at that stage. That's fine. No, that's fine, though. The only thing I would say is sometimes I feel like you have approached this where the players can do no wrong, and this is just their marionette pulling the strings, and he's responsible for everything.
No, but Andrew, and you can't.
I would say that he is proving that he is not the right man for the job. That is true. However, there are players on this team that are letting him down, that are letting the club down, that have not been good enough, and they are part of the problem, too. This is not just a Jose Mourinho problem. There are players on that team that are showing now that they've got to be moved on if Tottenham are going to take any next step back to being a consistent top four team.
Some of those are going to be players that were signed under Mourinho. Look at the reports we saw on ESPN FC just today about Matt Doherty.
Mm-hmm.
Mourinho wants him gone. How did it come to be that he ended up at the football club? If it was going to work out like this, I mean, what does that say about recruiting? You know,
I mean, you're right. You're talking about one of his guys that were brought in. I think
Bergwijn became a pinata for a period under Mourinho. And maybe Bergwijn was on the way into the club before Mourinho arrived. I can't quite remember. But he's in and he's gone for a period and then he's back. Look at the way he treats. Tottenham fans seem to be a little bit split on this, but Dele Alli, for example, I don't know. I just see so much of the same old stuff we've seen with him before. I never thought it was going to work. And now here Levy is reaping what he sowed.
Yeah. And we'll see where their season goes from here. I mean, they do have what on paper appears to be winnable matches coming up: Burnley, Fulham, Crystal Palace. Those are their next three. Mm. If they want to entertain any idea of the last couple months of the season having meaning, that's got to be 9 points right there. But I think right now with this team, they're just kind of in a place where no opponent you can look at and say, okay, well, that's a win. That one's a win. That one will be tough. But I think every one of these games is just kind of up for grabs. At least that's how it feels. Maybe, who knows, maybe one or two matches you get a 2-0 or something, you start to feel good and things can turn. We've seen that before, but where we're at right now, it just doesn't feel like that.
It is something in which we share, Andrew. Nothing is a given anymore.
Let's see, a couple other things that we wanted to get to. Manchester City over Arsenal last weekend. They scored early. And that was really it. It's kind of it's almost a different, like, this Manchester City in terms of dominance, you know, it's the same old story from their past dominant sides. That's 18 straight wins for them now. But in terms of how they go about it, it almost feels different to me than some of the other ones. Like scoring 1-0 early on and then almost shutting it down after that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just different, I feel, than how they've done things in the past.
You're right. I was listening to Jonathan Wilson, who said their press is a little bit different. It's a little less, which allows kind of more control defensively and doesn't leave as many gaps. So that's part of it. And we were talking about before Christmas, Andrew. Remember we were speaking that, oh, maybe Pep is, you know, saving something for the Champions League, or maybe he was just pulling the team back a little. Now, I don't honestly think he was deliberately trying to draw with West Brom in the middle of December. That's not what I'm saying. But there seemed as if Man City were playing a little bit more reserved, and now they're on this quite incredible streak, which we should talk about. 18 straight wins across all competitions. With 6 more wins, City will equal the longest ever run of 24 consecutive wins in all competitions in club football. Do you know who currently owns that club football world record of 24 consecutive wins?
This would be a total guess. I'm going to say Bayern Munich.
No, the mark was set 10 years ago by Brazilian club side Coritiba. Do you know, you won't know this one. I didn't even know it, but I looked it up. Do you know who holds Europe's longest domestic streak unbeaten? So unbeaten, we're not just talking wins. We're talking unbeaten.
In Europe?
Yeah.
All right.
European record.
Let's go with Ajax.
Oh, okay. Interesting. That would have been a good one for me too. No, Steaua Bucharest hold European football's longest domestic unbeaten record between 1986 and 1989.
Good Lord.
Good Lord. A good team, Stoya. Very dominant. But this is the kind of, maybe not quite like that, but maybe closer to Coritiba. But yeah, this is the zone City are in right now in terms of breaking records.
Yeah. I mean, look, when you've got 5'7" Raheem Sterling rising up over defenses to head in goals, it's just like everything is kind of going your way. And now De Bruyne is back. It's one of those things where we've talked about Manchester City in other years before, and I felt this way again looking at not their starting 11, but at their bench. And I'm just like, yeah. Okay, Phil Foden, Aguero, Rodri, Kyle Walker. I'm like, this is their bench. It's like that's what we're dealing with here in this club. They're a juggernaut after, I guess, last season kind of being a year off. They are right back at the top.
Yeah, which is kind of depressing considering what we laid out before Christmas for what this league might become in terms of a race. But there we are.
Yep, no race to be had. Chelsea, JJ, they put a little bit of a bump in the road in their road back to near the top of the table.
Yes.
Against a very out-of-form Southampton side, 1-1. So a couple things with this game. First off, in terms of most embarrassing things that can happen to an athlete, where does coming on as a sub in soccer and then getting subbed off rank? It's got to be near the top.
In football terms, it's the top. It's humiliating.
We're talking about Callum Hudson-Odoi, by the way, for anyone who isn't aware.
Yeah, and Tuchel said he cleared the air with him yesterday, but he also, right in the post-match press conference, literally said his standard was not good enough. Like, Tuchel clearly is a man on a short leash, the short leash being an 18-month contract. So he is not wasting any time with anybody, even a 20-year-old starlet who is wanted by a couple of German sides, I do believe. But he's not pulling any punches. It is pretty much the worst thing that can happen to you.
Like, what are other things you can think of? I was trying to brainstorm of, like, other hugely embarrassing kind of sports happenings. Like, this isn't nearly as bad, but in baseball, if they are intentionally walking someone because they want to face you, you know, that happens all the time, so it can't be quite as bad. But I feel like if you're that batter, it's kind of like, oh, they really don't think much of me, do they?
Wow, yeah. In American sport, I'm struggling with this one. I guess, you know, that the concept of could the concept of hack-a-shack be seen as demeaning? Just foul that guy because he'll definitely not score with a free shot.
Right. Yeah, that could be. I don't think any of these are as bad.
No, this is dreadful. I'm bringing you in to impact the game. Oh, you are so bad. I have to take you right off again. You're actually going to make things worse.
man, that's rough.
But it is interesting how he's attacked this. You know, he is not. He's a man who's on, like I said, a short leash, and he's going to move and move quickly. Let's put it this way. He's aware of his surroundings. He's not going to get too comfortable. I think if Pulisic's apartment in Chelsea is still pretty much unfurnished, I would imagine there is nothing in Tuchel's apartment.
Yeah. And speaking of Pulisic, I would say now would not be the right time to start furnishing it.
No.
So we joked last week that Thomas Tuchel hates America.
You joked that.
Oh, and what, you were serious? You think he actually does?
No. This is all you. I'm trying to push responsibility for things said onto you.
Christian Pulisic, obviously, he did not play again. There's more talk about injuries.
His calf, again.
Thomas Tuchel is now being asked in press conferences about Christian Pulisic's future, and he's trying to give diplomatic answers, but they're not necessarily ardent, strong, supportive statements that Christian Pulisic is going nowhere. You're not really hearing that.
No. And I'm going to lay out the case why he will probably go and leave Chelsea in the summer.
Okay.
But I should mention he is back in the squad for the Atleti game today, which is we're talking to you on a Tuesday. So, but Tuchel said yes today. Clearly, yes, we're responding to has Pulisic a future at Chelsea. But it's not only my point of view, so it's not down to me. We have to see. For me, clearly, yes, because Chelsea bought Christian for a reason, for his quality and his potential. So it's our job to bring out the best in him. He proved in many weeks that he has the level to be a Chelsea regular player, to have a big impact at this club. And it's a challenge now to maintain the level and to keep improving. Which is, let's be honest, quite a departure from the stock caught offside answer of the end of last season of the restart, where he is Chelsea's best player in our view. And I still think in those Frank Lampard sides, he was the best player. Here's why I think he'll go, Andrew. First of all, Tuchel's relationship with him is fine and everything. But like we said, Tuchel is a man in a rush. Thomas Tuchel has a short amount of time and he will want players who are available. That sounds like the most obvious thing in the world, but he can't wait around to see what next injury is going to happen to Christian Pulisic. Mm-hmm. He needs players that are going to be available for him to do what he wants to do in this period of time at Chelsea. Financial figures came out for Chelsea last week. Go to Swiss Ramble on Twitter. And it's so important for Chelsea and their finances in the last few seasons in particular that they've been able to sell players. That has been big in terms of balancing the books and keeping the books looking good. And I think Ms. Granovskaya will look at someone like Christian Pulisic and think, okay, look at what age he is. He's what, 22? He has some outstanding metrics and has had some good games for Chelsea, but we can't keep this guy fit. Now is the time to try and get some money back of the 75 million that we put out there to buy him. So the summer may be the opportune moment for them to do that.
Boy, I'm so curious if they would have to take a fine. Would they take a hit? Yeah, I mean, because like here, I'll say this: Thomas Tuchel, his comments about Pulisic, I'm not going to say that they're wrong. He's right to say, you know, we need players who what did he say? JJ, continue to improve. Like, okay, I get that he has to kind of have that sort of message that we can't have players resting on their laurels.
Right.
However, I do feel I'm going to put on my most patriotic of American underpants right now and almost become Christian Pulisic. But like, this is not a talent issue for me with Christian Pulisic. This is not like, how is he good enough to play at Chelsea? Like, I almost resent the idea that that's even being broached. I know
Tuchel's, but who's not saying that? I don't think we're saying that,
but I'm just trying to hammer home the idea of when this guy plays, he's the real deal. He's the goods. He's everything that we as American supporters and whoever the Chelsea supporters are out there, he's everything that you and us hope him to be. This to me is an injury issue only. That's really how I feel about this. And unfortunately, he's like all the things that we've talked about and the concerns that we've had as to whether or not he can stay healthy with these muscular injuries, these recurring damn muscular injuries. Like, that is the issue. I don't know if that changes at another club. I have no idea. But like, to me, this is not a time, like, if you're a Chelsea supporter that thought Chelsea paid too much for him and you're beating your chest saying, I was right, I knew he wasn't good enough for this club, I'm here to tell you, I still think you're wrong. This is not about that. I just think, unfortunately, his body is betraying him and I feel terrible for him.
Yeah, I'm not even broaching the idea that he's not good enough. I don't want that conversation anymore. That is past for me. He's an elite level player. Bayern Munich, apparently, this is the rumor mill has begun. Now, this all depends on what Kingsley Coman decides to do, whether he has a contract extension or whether he re-signs with Bayern, whether he decides he wants to move on. But the rumor was that Pulisic is viewed as a replacement for Coman, which would be
great.
Interesting to see him go back to Bayern Munich.
I think it would be great for him to play at Bayern Munich.
All right. Shall we park our Pulisic worries and fears and for a moment?
Sure. That's really most of what I have in terms of the Premier League. I did have one other thing, actually, that I wanted to mention, because we didn't do much on Manchester United this week. But I did want to mention one thing. Like, you were talking about Aaron Cresswell before as kind of like, almost a hidden gem at fullback in this league. And I kind of wanted to touch on another one, because when we talk about great fullbacks, you know, we talk Trent and Robertson, Cancelo. Today you've mentioned Cresswell, but I at least wanted to mention something about Luke Shaw, because when
we mentioned him last week.
Right. But like oftentimes I feel like when he gets talked about by fans, like, I don't know, for whatever reason, I feel like he's like more often a punchline than he is a guy who's there for praise, like his injuries or his size for his position.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention this one thing that I saw from the website Who Scored. And they noted after the Newcastle game that only 5 players in all of the Premier League have created more goal scoring opportunities this season than the 45 created by Luke Shaw. So props to him, because he's having a very good season, and you don't get a ton of people out there who are ready to tell you that. And I'm here to be one of those people.
Good man.
A couple other things not in the Premier League, JJ. Milan derby, Inter Milan, get a massive win over AC Milan. And Romelu Lukaku, JJ, while we're talking about Manchester United, a player who seems like he has almost completely rehabilitated his reputation from where it was when he left United to where it is now, where I think you'd have to view him as among the top. What would you say? Is he now, the way he's playing, a top 3 striker in the world?
Right now, yes, he would be. He would be considered that. Although, I mean, again,
I mean, who are we talking about? We're talking about like Lewandowski,
Haaland.
Yeah. Okay. So the group, I would say it's Lewandowski, Haaland, Mbappe,
Mohamed Salah,
Kane. Sure, Salah. I mean, does Luis Suarez still have to be included? He's tied with Messi for goals right now in La Liga.
See, the problem would be if you're Inter Milan, is where are they in the European spectrum, Andrew? Mm-hmm. And they are not in the Champions League. They went out in the group stages. So that creates a problem for assessing these players. So I I'm happy to put him in that list if you wish. I'm very happy to put him in there. I mean, his second goal, was it his second goal? The third goal, where he just races past the Milan defense and then lashes one in from about 20, 22 yards into the bottom corner, was a breathtaking goal.
Pretty impressive, and a huge win for Inter Milan. Meanwhile, also in Italy, JJ, Weston McKennie bags a goal for Juventus in their 3-0 win. Cristiano Ronaldo got the other two, but a nice goal for McKennie off of a corner kick and kind of like bounced around and then smashed it home. So good job by him. What was his celebration? Did you see it? Somebody said it was a Harry Potter celebration. Is that what it was?
Yeah, some Harry Potter thing. I don't know.
Why with such contempt?
I don't
you hate
I don't.
Harry Potter.
No, I know. I haven't read a book. I got dragged. Imagine I didn't read a single book and I got dragged to like the third one, the third movie. So I'm just sat there. I'm like,
by who? Your girlfriend?
No, it was a buddy of mine who was a big Harry Potter guy. He read all the books.
I just wonder about, I've never read any of the books either. I've never seen the movie.
That's not for me. I just know.
Really? You strike me as a big wizard guy.
Yeah.
I've always gotten that vibe from you, but this was like you didn't feel the ability to say, no, I'm good. I'm not doing it. Like you had to go with him to see Harry Potter. Asked me that, I'd said, I've never read a book. I've never seen a movie. Go ask someone else. Why would you say yes?
He was in this phase where he was trying to convince me that, you know, watch a film. Maybe that's in a doorway or a gateway into reading the books. But I'm like,
and let's start with the third one.
Yeah, it was one of those weird random ones in your 20s where you're like, oh, okay, I'll just do this. And I did buy a lot of popcorn and candies and chocolates. So I was pretty happy to just lay back and break wind into the movie theater seats as I just chomp away.
You really are that guy. If I'm not going to enjoy this, no one's enjoying it. I'm going to fart my way through this movie and I want you all to smell it.
I don't know why I added the farts. I would never fart in public. That's disgusting.
Well, good. And that's our analysis of Weston McKennie's goal from over there.
Yeah, no, I didn't know what the celebration was, but the internet told me it was Harry Potter, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Just Not my cup of tea, man.
Well, I'll say this about him. While like Christian Pulisic, and you know, while he kind of is like scuttling along at Chelsea, and it's not quite going the way that we had hoped it would, Weston McKennie, I feel like has been a big success. Like I couldn't possibly feel better about him and his development and where he's at moving
forward. I was watching a game, I think 2 weeks ago against Inter. I think it was Inter in the cup. And he's in midfield, Andrew, and he's like miles behind the play, and he just makes this sprinting run to the corner, sniffs out the danger, tracks down the attacking player. I can't remember, was it Perisic? I'm not even sure. And just slams him in a tackle, wins the ball out over the sideline. Like I said, he's just got this vibe of that all-action midfielder. And he reminds me, again, a little bit of young Roy Keane. Like, this is a great move that's going really well.
Seems a lot nicer and friendlier, though.
No, he does.
Like, I don't think I would be quite as scared to be around him as I would. If Roy Keane's face just appeared on this, like, Zoom chat right now, I think I might just, like, instinctively log off and hide.
We have to get him on the podcast. If he's going to be now so free with his time that he has social media, we have to get him on the podcast here. Just one thing, much less fun news about the Jordan Morris ACL injury at Swansea.
I'm going to mention that later.
Oh, you are? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Read none of what I sent you, and you've decided to go rogue.
I did not read the program notes, and I apologize.
And now you're paying for it. I hope you're embarrassed. We continue now, JJ. You have a mailbag, which I have read.
Okay. This is a good mailbag, little mailbag here. Caught Offside ESPN on Instagram, @SuasoccerPod on Twitter, caughtoffsidepod@gmail.com. Go on iTunes, rate us, do all those things. They're very important to us. This is from Shaolin the Baptist on Thierry Henry and Bournemouth. So, which still hasn't been confirmed, right?
Well, no, Bournemouth have named someone else, at least for the remainder of the season, have they not?
Oh, this is, I had not seen this. This must have happened in the interim. Bournemouth manager Jonathan Woodgate given job despite Thierry Henry links. I had not seen that. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, is an even weirder move considering Jonathan Woodgate's not exactly stellar time at Middlesbrough. Huh. Okay, but anyway, this is the point. So we tweeted out about how Bournemouth were in conversations with Thierry Henry, and I had said it kind of doesn't really make any sense, but Shaolin the Baptist got in touch and made a kind of an interesting point. I just wanted to share my thoughts around Thierry Henry and his consideration for the Bournemouth job. Before I do, I will acknowledge that I'm a huge Arsenal fan and Henry is my favorite player of all time, so I have a lot of bias here. That being said, I understand the conversation around his preparedness for his new position. He hasn't had a lot of success as a manager and he's just starting out. I even question whether or not he was ready for this new opportunity. I'd much rather him be in a position to be successful, and I thought Montreal was a great place for him to build and learn. On the other hand, if Frank Lampard can be put into the Chelsea job, whether he should have or should not have, then Henry can be given a chance at Bournemouth. That's why I can conflate Henry's readiness with representation of black managers. Decisions like this happen all the time across all sports, but disproportionately less for black coaches and managers. I understand that this is a complicated topic, and apologies if I'm not eloquently stating my point. You are. I just want to see former players of color getting the same chances as their white counterparts. Again, love the pod. Y'all do great work. Yeah, I had not thought about that angle, Andrew. There are hardly any black managers in the Football League. And I would look at it this way. For, you know, Thierry Henry is a legend, and that opens doors for him that are certainly not there for black coaches who are coming up the ranks in league football or in lower league football or trying to get their opportunities. So I had not really considered this. I suppose this, my white privilege is that I see Thierry Henry having a pretty indifferent managerial career and getting the Bournemouth job. And I think, that's not a good thing. That's not great. And I don't even think about what the knock-on effects of that, of having another, of having a black manager in the championship might mean. So yeah, I thought it was really good from Shaolin the Baptist.
I think it's a great point. Honestly, yeah. I love that point. He's right. Like, if guys like Frank Lampard are going to get chances, then why shouldn't guys like Thierry Henry get chances? I think.
Yeah, but it, Yeah, for me, it was just like, you know, I didn't think Frank Lampard should have got the chance, the opportunity he got at either Derby or Chelsea. I didn't think he'd done enough to earn it. But then, you know, it was amazing that how I maybe didn't think how difficult it is for a black manager to get a role in a championship team, and that Thierry Henry doing that is, I know he hasn't done it, but if he did do it, it kind of highlights this huge problem. I would like to think that more black managers who are not Thierry Henry could get a shot at this. I think that would be the ideal. This is a great story that is inspired by our Greece Euro 2004 chat last week from Paul Dolan. I just heard your mailbag conversation about Greek football and Euro 2004, and it brought back great memories. In late 2003, I decided it was time to take my first soccer road trip and attend Euro 2004. I went to the UEFA ticketing site and tried to buy Follow Your Team tickets to England, Portugal, Netherlands, Spain, France, Germany, etc., and they were all sold out. I looked at the qualification standings and saw that Greece were leading their qualification group and they had finals tickets available. What a weird system this is. So I purchased a Follow Your Team pass for Greece. Note, I have no Greek heritage. In June, I told my boss I'd be out of office for 2 weeks and pack my backpack. Greece win the opening match and host Portugal. And then we know what they went on to do. They beat defending champions France, Czech Republic, Portugal, all golden generations by 1-0 scorelines to win the title. It was exhilarating to celebrate with the Greek supporters and heartbreaking to see the Portugal supporters who had been such gracious hosts. Multiple times I had to call back to my boss and request an extension on my vacation. It was the most unbelievable soccer trip of my life, and that includes 3 World Cups. Thank you for reminding me of the memories of Euro 2004. Wow. First of all, you are a blessed individual that's been to 3 World Cups and a European Championships. That's the first thing.
And your boss is a good person.
Yeah, but the second thing is, like, what are the odds? You're like, how many games am I going to get out of this package following Greece? And they go all the way to the final and win the damn thing. All right. Finally, Pedram wants to know, I wanted to ask you guys, knowing that you're two huge football fans, how come you never even mention anything FIFA, the video game related?
Well, first off, I would say that's not totally true, because I think it was just 2 weeks ago that I mentioned Alexander Pato as being somebody who I thought FIFA, like, got him wrong. Like, I felt like his rating was always higher than the player he actually was. So we did reference it pretty recently. In terms of why we don't, so earlier in this podcast's existence, wasn't there 1 year where we actually had someone on to review FIFA? Was it like FIFA
2016, I think.
Yeah. So we did used to talk about it more. Why we don't now? I guess I don't really have a good answer to that. I just don't.
Lots of other things to talk about in, like, real soccer.
Well, I suppose there's that. I mean, for me, like, for a long time, it was the only video game that I continued to buy.
Yeah.
And I hate sounding like such a dweeb saying this, but, like, especially since I had my second kid, I haven't touched my PlayStation in such a long time. I don't know. I would love to sit down and just, like, bang out, you know, a few hours of playing it every once in a while, but
it's time consuming, man.
I just haven't been able to. One day, I can't wait for Jack and Luke to be older and, like, know how to play video games so I can play against them again.
It takes up so much time because
it doesn't have to. That was always one of the things that was good about FIFA, is that you could play, like, 3 games in a pretty short amount of time. Like, you get, like, 3 or 4 games done in an hour.
I'm just speaking for myself. Whenever I started playing, or, you know, FIFA or Championship Manager, I've had brief forays into these games, and it's just eaten up time. And that's half the reason why I don't go out and get a new console and start playing again, because I know that's the way it'll go.
I wonder if more people feel like this, though, what Pedram said, that they, like, want us to talk more about the video game. I don't really know in what terms he means. Like, is it a good game or not? Like, analyzing our own games, I'm not sure. But
yeah, I don't know.
I get it. Like, it's an awesome video game. I loved it for years.
And look, it's been a huge portal to soccer for so many people in this country and around the world. So yeah, I get it. But I don't know. I'm sure there's specific gaming podcasts you can listen to for your FIFA hit.
There you go. JJ's too learned. He needs to spend that time reading, consuming medical journals.
No, I'm not, but I do prefer reading, you know. So
wow.
God.
Wow. He actually was serious.
Where have we got to in this country where "oh, you read" is some kind of a slag? God.
All right, let's do this now, JJ, as we wind down the show. A little bit of red card man of the match. I'm going to start with my red card, and you referenced it a little bit earlier, and it is Jordan Morris. Not him, of course, but the situation around him. It's enough to make you sick, quite frankly. Swansea City manager Steve Cooper announced yesterday what we had unfortunately expected. He said this: he's had a bad injury, unfortunately for him. It's significant ligament damage, ACL, everything we hoped it wasn't. Unfortunately, it is, Cooper said on Monday. It's the end of his season for us and a long road back to recovery. It's very cruel. Oh, man. I mean, it was only a couple years ago, 2018, Morris missed the season for Seattle when he tore his ACL in the CONCACAF Champions League, came back from that, was an even better player in Jordan Morris 2.0 than the original version. He won MLS's Comeback Player of the Year. He had reemerged as one of the best players in the league, earned his spot, I think, with the national team. And now who knows? He's 26 years old, and his future is once again in flux. And it's just so cruel, as this kind of next chapter of his career was only just beginning. And it felt promising. But now Swansea, Seattle, the U.S. Men, Gold Cup, World Cup qualifying, it's all going to be placed on hold. And he's going to have to start over and go through the rehab process and work his way back into whether it be the national team picture or Swansea or Seattle, whoever he returns to. It just sucks. It sucks. He's come back to the U.S. He's going to have surgery in Santa Monica. And I can't stress it enough. Anyone who's been listening to this podcast, I feel like it's almost become like a joke in some ways over the last few years. But like, I've got such love for this guy and his game. Yeah. And I just can't say it enough. We wish him all the best, and we can't wait to see him playing again, hopefully, you know, a year or so from now.
I've got another injury situation for my right car.
All right.
Colin O'Doy at ESPN FC, he's writing about Napoli forward Victor Osimhen, who was discharged to return to Naples on Monday after spending the night under observation at a hospital in Bergamo following an alarming collapse towards the end of the club's 4-2 Serie A defeat by Atalanta on Sunday. Osimhen was knocked unconscious in a scary incident during the final minutes of the game after a challenge with Christian Romero. He was stretchered off the pitch and taken directly to hospital. A close advisor to the player told ESPN that a disorientated Osimhen was shocked when he saw the video of the incident. He could not believe it when they showed him the video. He said it felt like a brain reset.
Aye.
Multiple reports say the Nigerian regained consciousness on the way to hospital, but the source tells ESPN that Osimhen was out for slightly longer. He said he lost consciousness for about 30 minutes. That was not until they got to the hospital that he actually realized what was happening around him, and that was when they showed him the video.
30 minutes?
That's just horrifying.
Yeah, that's really, really frightening.
And the term brain reset. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That was a wild game, by the way. It was 0-0 at the half, was it not?
Yeah.
All six goals came in the second half.
It was a tremendous game, actually. And there were some really good goals in it, too. It was very enjoyable. But Napoli and Atalanta, if you were picking two teams for enjoyable football in Serie A, that would be them.
Yeah. Let's see. One more here, JJ. My women of the match. I wanted to talk about this. U.S. women, they're going to take the field Wednesday night against Argentina. They'll need just a draw to be crowned champions of this year's She Believes Cup. This comes after they kind of eked out a 1-0 win over rivals Canada and then once again found a way against a pretty difficult and good Brazilian side thanks to goals from Kristen Press and Megan Rapinoe. I continue to watch this team, JJ, and I continue to beat this drum of how do you beat them? I mean, Argentina, I'm sure, are going to do what they do. They're going to try to slow the game down. They're going to try to make it ugly. But it doesn't matter because I feel like this U.S. women's team can win in any number of ways. They can dominate possession. They can beat you on the counter. They're great through set pieces. We've seen that time and time again. They are just – they're top-level quality at every position on the pitch. And I know, you know, this tournament hasn't been flawless for them. There's been some kind of, like, frightening moments here and there. Crystal Dunn made a great kind of last-ditch tackle.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
Have you seen the slow-mo?
No, I only saw the regular in real time.
Oh, she comes out of the picture just out of nowhere, brilliant tackle. She's her stock is rising with every game.
Oh yeah, no, she's fantastic. But like I was thinking about, so in this last game against Brazil, you know, you're watching this game and you think about what the opposing team must be thinking. It's the 71st minute, and the U.S. is going to make substitutions. So off comes Alex Morgan and Kristen Press, so they can bring on Megan Rapinoe and Carly Lloyd. Like we were talking before about Manchester City and like what they have on their bench, and I almost feel like that pales in comparison to what the U.S. women can do. It's unbelievable. By the way, for Press, it's worth mentioning she's now up to, I believe, 59 goals, which like I was going to say it's a quiet 59 because that's a huge number. I might want to even double check it, but I feel uncomfortable saying it's a quiet 59 goals because we always talk about how all of her goals are amazing. And that was the case once again. She had a beautiful one to open the scoring against Brazil. So this team is just, they're a joy to watch. It's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock on FS1, US and Argentina. Like I said, a draw is all the US will need to take home the She Believes Cup title. Unbeaten in 36 straight, JJ, and 52 straight on U.S. soil. Just, they're a machine. They are a machine.
They make Steaua Bucharest look like complete schlubs. My man of the match is it's the situation. The Premier League clubs will be able to welcome up to 10,000 fans back to stadiums on the final weekend of the season. Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke in the House of Commons yesterday ahead of laying out a roadmap for England's move out of lockdown. During the speech, he confirmed that stadiums will be able to host 10,000 fans or a quarter of full capacity, whichever is smaller, from May 17th. The final day of the season is May 23rd. So that is interesting. Now, it's not guaranteed. There will be monitoring of the situation and of infection rates, etc. But this is the roadmap. This is the plan. The Athletic goes on to report a further step in the roadmap sees all restrictions lifted on June 21st. This would be significant for Euro 2020. Wembley is set to host the semi-finals and final of the competition. That could mean a full stadium for the showpiece game on July 11th. So we will be watching this. It'll also be interesting that for crucial relegation battles and possibly top four matchups, there could be fans in the stadium for some of these games, which is kind of an interesting little wrinkle into things. You can imagine, you know, we got relegated on the final day because they had their fans at the ground, you know. After a season where everyone has played without, well, that's not even true either, because there were some fans back briefly before they locked down again. So maybe it's not that much of a wrinkle. It has been inconsistent. There have been fans in the ground, but this will be fans in the ground at a pretty crucial time.
Yeah. Like the final week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could. So, I don't know. To see it again, like I would say as soon as they feel comfortable doing it, they just go for it.
It's amazing that, you know,
okay with it.
In previous years, we've had Lasagna Gate. That sorted out the outcome of a race for the Champions League. What else have we got? Carlos Tevez gate, where he wasn't properly registered and that relegated Charlton. And now we have fans in the stadium gate.
Oh, you think this rises to that level, huh?
No.
I don't view it as anything like untoward.
No, it's not. Like I said, there was already fans in the stadium briefly. So it's just little inconsistent.
Well, it'll look nice. I mean, it's like, I'm kind of getting tired of this. No fans in stadiums. It's just, I don't know. I'm ready to see people, you know, back celebrating and being happy and all that again. So, yeah, we'll see. By the way, I did double check. Kristen Press, it is 59 international goals, which is outstanding. I mean, to put it in perspective, like Donovan and Dempsey are the all-time U.S. men's leaders with 57. I know it's not apples to apples, just kind of like, putting that out there is just like a reminder, like, because she's not, when we talk about like the great American women goal scorers of this era, it's kind of like Lloyd, Wambach, Morgan. Like, I don't know how many names you would go through before you got to Kristen Press, but God, she's just like a ruthless goal scorer for them. So props to her and good stuff. Good stuff all around. Our thanks to Rashane Thomas, who joined us from The Athletic to talk about West Ham as we went in the club with them in their race to maintain top four status. We got Champions League midweek. I hope everybody enjoys games. Some of them have probably happened by now. I know Chelsea and Atletico are in action today. Bayern and Lazio as well, I believe.
Yeah, which a couple of people noted is just like a matchup that you never see. Yeah. It's just such a weird coming together of two teams that would never usually play each other.
Yeah. So there we are. But yeah, it should be a fun midweek, and then we're back at it again over the weekend. So good stuff, man. Good stuff to you. Thanks to everybody out there who listened this week. We'll be back at it again next week. To you, I say...
Check you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships. Your skills. Your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network.